Today is Monday, May 25th, 2020. This is a part four interview with Esther Litton, spelled E-S-T-H-E-R-L-I-T-T-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Esther. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm fine, thank you.
Great. Esther, may we have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. Yesterday we finished up with 1952, and Martin was hiking in to the bottom of the Grand Canyon at the top of Lava Falls Rapid, a very steep and hot route to hike down. Do you remember how he knew those river runners would be there?
Yes. Martin and I had made that hike before, I think a year before. And when we got to the bottom, there was nobody there, but he wanted a picture of the river. Later, he convinced one of the employees at the Los Angeles Times to join him again. And I don't know why he wanted to go back, but the gentleman who went with him was from the Los Angeles Times. They hiked down. I don't think that Martin knew that Frank Wright was going to be there. It's possible that he did know, but I don't have that information. But when they got to the bottom, to the Lava Falls, Frank Wright was there. He had taken over the river business from Norman Nevels, who had died in a plane crash. And Frank Wright, I think, ran just one trip during the summer, but he had a couple of ladies as his passengers, and I don't know who else. But also Georgie White was there with a passenger. She was in a raft, and she wanted to go down Lava Falls at the same time Frank Wright did, so that she would follow the right course.
Okay. Did Martin hike down with a fellow named Lefty Bryant?
Correct, yes.
What do you remember about Lefty?
I don't know a thing about, I didn't know a thing about Lefty. He might have been a janitor for all I know.
Okay.
Someone who wanted to do the hike.
Okay. And what did Martin, what did he think about that? He hiked down, it would have been hot. You guys had done it before. He knew it was hard.
Yeah, it's very hot and it's volcanic ash and you're sliding down most of the way. And when Martin and I hiked down, he had a heavy backpack and his tripod and his camera. So that, and hiking back up was even more difficult because we kept slipping back. But that was the hike that we made. And I imagine that the hike down with Lefty Bryant was equally hot and fragile with the volcanic ash.
When you were there in probably maybe 51, did you meet John and Laura Riffey? Did you meet John Riffey?
Oh, I'm sure we did, because we had to check in with him. He was a ranger at the Grand Canyon National Monument, and I don't remember what year we met him, but that's probably the year we did. At that time, he was married to his first wife, who died later, but Riffey was very kind to put water along the trail for us because he anticipated that we would need water.
Nice. What else do you remember about John Riffey?
Well, he was very affable and very helpful and was eager to help us in any way he could. We met him many times later on with his second wife, who was an avid bird watcher. I think she taught in Oregon, some university in Oregon, his second wife. But anyway, do you want me to go on with the Frank Wright?
Yeah, yes, please.
Okay. As a result of that meeting, the ladies invited, got in touch with Martin later that month that they were going to have a big get-together in San Fernando Valley at someone's home where they were going to talk river trips and show slides. So Martin and I did go that autumn to a home in San Fernando Valley. And at that meeting, which lasted for hours, we met Pat Riley.
Okay.
That was our first meeting with Pat and Susie Riley.
Okay, that's good, because that was a question I had for you, is how did you meet Pat and Susie?
Yes, well, we did.
Okay.
And then, of course, if I jump ahead to when Martin started at Sunset, probably I shouldn't jump ahead yet, but I have to introduce the fact that because of the Los Angeles Times articles, one of which caught the Sierra Club's eye, which was called Yosemite's Beauty Fast Disappearing, which Martin wrote to indicate the pollution that existed in Yosemite at that time because of the many, many cars that traveled to Yosemite to watch the fire fall, and they were trampling the meadows anyway. Because of that article and the others about dinosaur, David Brower had contacted Martin. Either he had come down to Los Angeles to meet, I don't remember when Martin met Dave Brower, but in 1954, David Brower was approached by Sunset Magazine because Sunset had just lost their travel editor who had moved on. And they needed another travel editor. They suggested the job to Dave Brower. He wasn't interested, but because he had met Martin and read the different articles on conservation and travel, he suggested that they contact Martin. And in the spring of 1954, I think in the spring of 54, Martin was interviewed, went north to Menlo Park, where he was interviewed by Mr. and Mrs. Lane. And he left a portfolio that had pictures and articles that he had done. He had some things that had been published in Arizona Highways. He had something that had been published in the National Geographic, something in Pacific Pathways, so he had a fairly rich portfolio of his work and his writings, and they offered him the job.
Okay.
But at that time,
No, that's fine. I just said, okay, keep going.
Oh,
yep, they offered him the job.
Of course, we hadn't been in the house that we built for too many years, just a few years, and we didn't want to sell the house. And it was a question whether they would be interested, Sunset would be interested in a conservation angle that Martin wanted to bring. He wanted to bring conservation into any article that he might write. So he accepted the job, and the kids and I stayed behind and finished the upstairs, which had been left unfinished. It included two bedrooms and a bath, and we didn't want to sell the house at that point, but we rented it out for a year. And because we thought if the job at Sunset didn't work out, we could always come back home to Los Angeles. So Martin reported to Sunset around April or May of that year. And then the kids and I followed in June. The first article that was planned for the following summer was a big article on the Grand Canyon. So Martin besides figuring out other articles, other travel articles to work on, he wanted to include the river experience in the coming big article on the Grand Canyon. And to do that, he contacted Pat Riley, whom we had met in San Fernando Valley, and asked him if he was going to run a trip in the summer of 1955. And Pat said yes, he was going to run a trip in June of 1955. So, shall I jump to 1955?
Well, unless there's some neat things to talk about for 53 and 54.
Well, I don't remember anything specific except the river trip on the in the dinosaur. And,
okay, we... right.
And the kids. One born in 46 and the other born in 49.
So that's John and Catherine? Right, and so while Martin was looking to get the job at Sunset, you were raising the kids and working on the house.
Yes, because Martin left early around April or May, and then while he was gone, I got a contractor to finish the upstairs.
Okay.
And we arranged to move. I think we moved in June. Martin had found a house in Menlo Park that we could rent for a year. So the kids and I came out of Menlo Park and moved into this house in Menlo Park.
And that was closer to the Sunset offices?
Yes, it was. But the people who owned the house would only rent it for a year.
Okay. Wow, what did you do?
Well, we knew we couldn't rent the house in Menlo Park after June, so we did find a house to rent in a town called Los Altos. And that was much farther from the Sunset, but it was near a nice shopping center in Los Altos, and it was a nice house. So we had arranged that when we came back from the river trip, we would move from Menlo Park to Los Altos.
Wow. So I want to ask about the kids again. When you went on that river trip in the summer of 1955, where did the kids go?
Well, they went to stay with my mother in Los Angeles.
Okay. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was very apprehensive about the trip. I had seen pictures of the canyon in the National Geographic, and it seemed to me that it might be very claustrophobic. But it turned out to be entirely the opposite. It was a very hot June. June is the hottest month in the Grand Canyon. Oh, but I should explain first. Two or three weeks before we left for the Grand Canyon, Martin had been on a scouting trip in the Kings Canyon. And during that trip, crossing a river, the horse had stumbled and fallen, and Martin had been tossed out onto a waterfall, and he'd fallen on this waterfall. And in trying to get his balance and get his pack off of his back, he dislocated his shoulder.
Ouch.
So the pack went disappearing down the river, but the people with the packer who was with him, of course, got him out of the water, but they still were a day and a half to where the cars were, to where they could get him to a hospital. But they did get him to a hospital, and the doctor relocated his shoulder, and Martin said, well, now am I going to be able to row? Because in 3 weeks I'm leaving on a river trip and I'm supposed to row one of the boats. And the doctor said, you absolutely cannot row. You keep it in that sling and don't lift it. So where he was supposed to have rowed one of the three boats that we took, he had to stay quiet for a while. It didn't last very long because he still had the tripod and the camera and the film because, of course, he intended to take pictures. But he didn't manage to get a very good shot, a color shot that was used on the inside of the magazine of Havasu, where we were putting the boats in there to Havasu. It was almost a three-week trip. But Pat Riley did not like to take passengers through the rapids, so we walked around everything. In fact, Pat Riley didn't, he wanted to line a lot of them. He wasn't comfortable running a lot of the rapids. And when we got to Horn, one of the boats, the boat one and one of the boats turned over in Horn, and he was all right, but he lost a couple of oars. And so when we got to Granite, which is below Horn, we stayed there watching to see if we could spot the oar that had been lost. But Pat Riley had some material on the boat, and he fashioned another oar, temporary oar. By the end of the trip, Martin was moving his arm around and able to maneuver the tripod and the camera. And actually, the next year, 1956, he went again with Pat Riley, and that time he rowed one of the boats.
Okay.
When we went, there were just three boats and nine people. There were just Susie and Pat, and I was the other woman. The others were gentlemen, men who Pat Riley knew from his work at Northrop. So anyway, 1956, Martin went again.
What do you remember about Pat and Susie Riley? What do you remember about them?
Oh, well, they were very knowledgeable about the river, and Pat and Susie, they had worked out a very Spartan menu. Pat was very agreeable, very, very cheerful, and very knowledgeable about the river. But he was quite cautious. As I say, when we got to Lava Falls, we emptied the boats of everything. And Pat, Susie and I carried buckets of food and cans around to the bottom of Lava Falls, while the boatman Pat and the other gentlemen lined the boats to the bottom of Lava Falls.
Okay.
So we didn't run lava at all. In fact, as I say, like soap, pants, any of those, and Horn, we walked around all of them. We did stop at Phantom Ranch, and we walked up to the ranch, and we spent the night in one of the cabins at Phantom Ranch.
Okay. What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember there was a swimming pool, which in later years was filled because of a storm. And I remember that was a mule party with riders that had just come down the Kaibab Trail, and the people were having trouble getting off of the mule.
Yeah.
They were very so tired. I remember that it was a very pleasant facility. The food was great, and the people who had ridden down were really pretty tired and sore.
I bet. Gosh.
There were some bad floods along the creek there, and eventually they filled up the swimming pool, so it doesn't exist anymore.
Well, you had a chance to go swimming there. That's pretty neat.
there.
Okay.
Yeah.
What else do you remember about that river trip in general?
Well, it was such a revelation. And the thing is, there was nothing claustrophobic about it at all, because each canyon had something tempting. And we did some of the side hikes. And of course, we stopped at Havasu and Elves Chasm. And Martin was taking pictures, as I say, along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a long pull out, because at that time we went out at Temple Bar, which was a long, long trip over Lake Mead.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, we moved into Los Altos, and it was a very comfortable home. We were there until, while we were there, the traffic was hard for Martin, and it would take him a half an hour to get to Menlo Park because the traffic was building up. So when it looked like we would be staying, we started looking around for a place or a property. And then at that time, we decided to put the house up for sale. And in 1950, I'm trying to think what year, I think it was 1957 or 56, we saw the property at a place called Portola Valley, which is on the edge of the end of Stanford land and the beginning of private land. And it was called Portola Valley. And we looked at some property there. I wasn't too eager for the place because the lot that Martin favored, while it was almost 4 acres, there was a limited area on which you could build a house. But it was a beautiful spot. And at the time, I was pregnant with Donald, and I really didn't want to argue. $9,000 for the 4 acres at the time, but there was a heavy rainfall that particular spring, a steady rainfall, which the loft that we had a pad to build on off of the street, but then it had a slope and another slope, and the rain saturated the slope. And it all sloped down so that we didn't have a lower level on which to put the lower part of the house. So it involved getting an engineering company to come in and re-stabilize the slope. And it has stayed stabilized to this day. They did a wonderful job.
Wow.
So here again, we designed the house and got a builder. And this time, we got the Calvet loan. And the CalVet loan required that you have the property paid for and the plans ready. And I don't think they gave you more than a year to get all of this together.
Wow.
So it was a rush to design the house and the plans. And so we did manage to build it. And the children, actually, in the later years, loved the place because... Well, we didn't have much of a lawn for them to play ball on. They had the hillside, which was heavily wooded with oaks and madrones and also poison oak. But they built a little trail through the woods, and they played on special, they had a special rock. So over the years, all of them felt that they had had a magical childhood in that particular home. Situation.
Nice. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yes. Well, I don't know whether I should jump to 1960, because at that time, the South American Tourist Agency contacted the Lanes and said, look, they had never had an article on South America. Would they consider sending their travel editor to South America? So it was arranged that Martin and I, because I man who was the agent. We were to go in 1960 for a month, divided between Chile and Argentina. So that was what we did in 1960. We flew to Mexico City and changed planes to Canadian Pacific, which flew down to South America. We flew down the edge of Peru, over the Andes and into Buenos Aires, and spent 2 weeks in Buenos Aires, and then we did the lake route where you go down to Bariloche and Puerto Montt, Puerto Varas, in the southern part of Chile, where we crossed over to Chile, and then visited the cities of Puerto Varas and Puerto Montt in Chile, and then took the train up the coast to Santiago, where Martin did some shooting there. We took the train that goes over the Andes from Santiago to Argentina, but we took it just to the top, where it reached the top of the Andes, and then we turned around and took the train back down, because we didn't have time, or we didn't want to get caught on the Argentine side. So he had the train trip, and then we flew to Panama, because the money was running out. And Martin still had, I had promised to be home at the end of the month, and the month had already passed, and I was anxious to get home. So I came home from Panama City. Incidentally, in Panama City, we went into a camera shop where Martin was able to buy his Hasselblad, and the Hasselblad was lenses, some very good lenses, came to just $500.
Wow.
And there were no charge accounts or anything like that, but we said, we wrote a check. For some reason, we had a checkbook. We wrote a check for the $500, but asked him not to cash it until we got home.
Oh, nice.
And so he did. He agreed to that. But Martin stayed on and visited the Guianas. He spent a day, I don't know how long, but each one. He went to the British Guiana, Dutch Guiana, and French Guiana, and covered those photographically. And while he was in Dutch Guiana, which is also Suriname, he met a jungle guide at their tour office, Tony Van Omren, who said, come back and we have rivers to run.
How do you spell Tony's last name?
It was Vanomm. I have to say, E-M-E-N, I say Omron. I'm not doing it correctly. There's an E-R in there somewhere. I can't see it. But he was part Bush Negro, part Carib Indian, part Dutch.
Wow.
And he was very well educated, and he knew the jungle, the area very well, and he would lead tours. So it was the beginning of a long friendship with Tony Van Omren.
Nice. Huh.
Anyway, we did those two countries in 1960, and in 1965, we spent a month in Colombia and a month in Venezuela. And the exciting part, well, it was all very exciting. We were in Bogota, which is very high, and from there we took an army plane that took us down to the Amazon, where Colombia had a city named Leticia, and also their navy, a navy ship there, which was visited one of the native villages, and we flew in a plane that was delivering postage to an outpost, an army outpost, up one of the branches of the Amazon.
Wow.
And when we landed there on the water, it was a water landing, the pilot took us over to a large native village, which was interesting. But it also gave us a chance to see from the air the extent of the river system and the beautiful rainforest that existed. It was a beautiful flight.
Nice. Gosh.
And Leticia, it was just a small town, and we met a guide who was doing something really illegal. He was catching some of the wildlife and shipping it to the United States, which later he was arrested and put in jail. But he was a very competent guide. Anyway, we did get back to Bogota, but what happened when we were in Leticia, Martin had gotten malaria during the army games during the war. And the trip to Leticia, which was at Amazon level, and the heat apparently triggered the malaria again. So when we got back to Bogota, the hotel, he was very ill. He was shaking 1 minute and then very hot the next. And fortunately, there was a doctor in the hotel who helped Martin get well.
Nice.
But then from Bogota, we went to Venezuela. And the airport was on the coast, and Caracas is inland. You have to take the freeway. There's a freeway that goes over the mountain into Caracas. And at that time in 1965, the mountain, which was Mount Avila, I think, was pure rainforest, beautiful. And Caracas, the hotel where we stayed at Tequendama, I think, was very comfortable. And we were able to get a flight to a place called Canaima, which was inland. And on that flight, which was on a small plane, by that I mean it held about 10 people. It wasn't just a two or four place thing.
Okay.
But on that flight, the pilot took us over. But before we got to the dirt strip at the place called Canaima, we went past Angel Falls.
Oh, wow.
And Angel Falls is the highest waterfall in the world. And several years before that, Martin had met Jimmy Angel when Jimmy Angel was in Los Angeles trying to get money so that he could go back to Angel Falls, where he thought there was gold.
Huh.
But anyway, the pilot let Martin come up into his co-pilot seat, and he made several runs in front of the falls so Martin could get some good pictures.
Wow!
And we were fortunate that there was no fog or clouds, anything covering the mesa, they call Tepuy, where the falls were, and Martin got some good pictures. Unfortunately, some of the people got airsick because the pilot made several swoops so Martin could get some good pictures.
Oh, my.
But the landing was at a camp called Canaima. And Canaima, at a lower, much lower level, also had some waterfalls. Nothing like Angel Falls, but they were very picturesque. And it was, I think it was a dirt strip that we landed in. And the cabin where we stayed had an aluminum roof. And it rained very hard that night, and it was very noisy.
Hmm.
But the accommodations were fine. It was elementary. It was Spartan, but it was fine. And, of course, the area was perfectly beautiful. So that was our adventure in that part of Venezuela. But we also went to other areas, where Martin got pictures.
You know, let's go back a little bit between, that 1955 to 1965. Where else did Sunset send Martin? Where else did he go? Do you remember?
Well, he did very many major stories. In the summer, he would schedule a story, a big story, that the kids and I could go on. They didn't send him. They would work out the stories and the areas that they wanted to cover. There was a fairly big story where we went to Vancouver Island. So Vancouver Island was the main story for travel that summer. And then another summer, we went to Yellowstone, and he did a big story on Yellowstone. And then we did a pack trip with the kids, with the two kids, to the Kern Plateau. That was a three-week pack trip with two horses. And Martin, in the meantime, had also, he had convinced the older Lanes that they could sure use an airplane. And he had a pilot's license. So they did invest in an airplane, which made it possible for Martin to get around to some of these areas. But he did, there was a big story scheduled for Baja, and that involved flying down to Baja. And in September 1960, there was a big story scheduled for the Coast Redwoods, for the Redwood Country. And it was several pages long. And in the captions and in the pictures, Martin had taken a picture of a very large cut in the highway where several redwoods, of course, had been eliminated, and to widen the highway. It was along the Eel River somewhere. And as a result of that picture and that article, many people wrote in and said, what was happening? Why were they cutting down those trees? You know, and so it started. What happened was that the Weyerhaeuser company that was doing a lot of clear cutting, and another lumber company, a couple of lumber companies up there that were doing clear cutting, were alerted to the fact that Martin was zeroing in on the destruction that was going on in the Redwood Country. And so they watched the articles very carefully to see what in the world he was saying or writing. And as a result of that, I'm afraid I have to jump to 1968. But when Martin left Sunset, I don't know whether you want any other things in between.
I do. I do, but you know what? Let's jump to 68 and we'll finish that little story off and then we'll go back.
Yeah, because in those years from 1955 to 1968, Martin was very involved in the Sierra Club. He was on the board of directors, and so many of the big issues came up at that time. There was the Coast Redwoods, and there was Mineral King, and so all of these things, there was so much going on besides Sunset Stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't remember exactly which is which.
You know, I did want to ask you, though, during this time, from 55 to 68, what do you remember about David Brower?
Excuse me, what was the last thing?
What do you remember about David Brower?
Oh, yes. Well, he became a very good friend, and he would come by for lunch frequently. And Martin was in almost daily contact with him about different issues. And, of course, while he was there, the problem with the Grand Canyon came up, the dams. And of course, David Brower had to report to the board his conscience, because Martin had not. Martin could suggest some particular avenue of performance, but it would get Dave Brower in a lot of trouble with the powers that be at the Sierra Club. So while Martin could suggest something outrageous, David Brower couldn't always do what Martin was suggesting. But I'm trying to think what other projects were going on during those years.
David had some kids. Did his kids play with your kids?
He was what?
David had some children.
Oh, yes, he did. Kenneth Brower and John Brower, and he had a daughter, and I think he had two sons or three sons. I'm not sure. But Kenneth Brower went on to write books, and I think the daughter became a geography professor in Oregon, but I never met any of them except Kenneth Brower.
I wondered if they played with your kids, and it sounds like...
No, there was never anything like that. We weren't the same age, and David Brower lived at the top of Berkeley, and we lived down in Los Altos. Geographically, we weren't close at all. Martin's association with David Brower was mainly through meetings, the board meetings which took place, and he would go up. I never went to any of the board meetings, but Martin went to all the board meetings and any other special meetings that were going on in San Francisco at the Sierra Club. And then Martin was on the publications committee, so he was instrumental in the creation of Time and the River Flowing and The Last Redwoods, those two books. And,
you know, there's another question I wanted to ask you about Berkeley. Did Martin get a chance to meet a guy named Otis Marston?
Oh, yes. I was trying to think of his name. Yes, he was a very, very good friend of Martin's and a correspondent. Lots of correspondence between Otis and Martin. And Otis Martin is really the historian going way back of the Grand Canyon. And he did many deep studies of the people, of the land, just very deep studies of the whole area. And his papers are in the archives of Huntington Library.
Okay. Did you get a chance to meet him and his wife? And what do you remember about them?
I only met Otis and his wife. We had dinner one night in Berkeley. I did meet his wife. She used to be... When he went down the Grand Canyon with other people, he had to have a room party. And I forget her name, but anyway, she was listed as his room party.
Okay. Yeah, Margaret. Margaret was her name.
Oh, Margaret. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, there was a lot of correspondence, a lot of phone calls between Martin and Otis. They argued about different things, about who did what and when did it all happen. Oh, they conversed a lot, and he was a very, very knowledgeable man.
Okay. Let's see. We were talking about places that Martin went, and you mentioned Baja and the Kern Plateau. Where is that?
It's in the Southern Sierra.
Okay.
It's a more gentle part of the Sierra. And when we first moved up to Menlo Park, Martin was concerned about the conservation tactics he wanted to take. And we went to Mammoth to meet a couple, John Hadaway. And John Hadaway at the time was very concerned about the Kern Plateau because of the cutting that the Forest Service was doing. So later on, Martin scheduled this story with the pack trip that we made into what was called the Kern Plateau. And get up to Cottonwood Pass, which was pretty high, it was about 9,000 feet. Now there's a highway that goes up there. But from there, we went over another pass down into, trying to think, we did, we went to a place called Crabtree Meadows. It was a long trip, and I can't remember the itinerary. But at one point, we were camped at a place called Guitar Lake, which is on the west side of the Sierra. But it has a trail and the Hitchcock Lakes. Kathleen and I stayed behind. John and Martin climbed Mount Whitney. It was a fairly, not easy, but it was an accessible climb for the day. I think that they just took a day to do it. But while we were there, there was a hiker who came by who had hiked up and had also climbed Mount Whitney. But it turned out he was quite ill. And by the time we caught up with him later at a 10,000-foot level near Lake Wales, he was very ill, and he died at the camp.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a different story. I won't go into that because that was a different thing that happened. But
that's tragic.
Yes, it was very, because what he had was what later has been described as pulmonary edema.
Oh, altitude sickness. Yeah.
Yeah, and the altitude didn't help. And so there was quite a session with helicopters coming in.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a whole different story. I don't want it. Okay. I don't think you want me to get into that.
You know, there is a question in this time period I was thinking about that I do want to ask you. Glen Canyon Dam construction started in, I'm thinking, 54, 55, and finished there and, well, closed in 63 to take the river. Yeah.
And then I've lost track of the time and the years, but
62 maybe, somewhere in there, 63.
Yeah, about that. I could check with my son John about the year. Kathleen remembered the trip as like 1960 or 61.
Uh huh. Okay,
there's
another, well, I just wondered, I know that David Brower did some river trips in Glen Canyon just before the dam started backing up, and
yes, he probably did. We were invited at one point. that October, or maybe it was, yes, it was in October of 51, the first time we went with the kids to Dinosaur, we had the choice of going to Dinosaur or doing the Glen Canyon.
Oh.
And Martin chose to go to Dinosaur. So we never went, we never ran Glen Canyon.
Okay.
Well, the years that Martin was at Sunset were so active in different ways.
Yes.
He was so busy with the redwoods and the clear cutting in the redwoods and the attempt of the Sierra Club to create the national park that would protect what was left of the virgin coast redwoods, and then the fight with the lumber companies, because each time the Sierra Club came up with a boundary, some kind of a size of what they wanted in the national park, the lumber company would start cutting at the edge of where they wanted to start the park or include, enlarge the park boundaries. So it was a constant fight between what the Sierra Club, how they wanted the park to be, and what the lumber company was not willing to give up.
Right.
And Martin did quite a few, well, he did a lot of aerials of the area to show where they were clear cutting and what was left of the virgin forest. So it was a constant tug of war between the two. And maybe you remember Julie Butterfly Hill, who camped for a year at the top of one of the coast redwoods.
Right.
Yeah. And Martin flew her father in so he could climb up and spend time with her. And Woody Harrelson, the actor, wanted to visit. Anyway, there was so much disconnected. There were so many disconnected events that I have trouble keeping them in order.
It sounds like a very busy time.
It was. It was a very busy time, and I have trouble remembering the years.
Right. I was trying to think, are there other river runners that you remember during that time?
Well, let's see, there was, there were the ones who used the pontoons, which Martin didn't like, and some of their boatmen, when they saw the dories, they wanted to come over and row on the dories and leave the pontoons. I'm trying to think that there was Arca, and I think George Wendt also had a permit, a limited permit on the Grand Canyon. And I really don't, I'm trying to think who else, I'm sorry, but I don't remember who the other river runners were.
Oh, I was thinking about, Gaylord Stavely and...
Yes, Martin did know him. I never met him, but Martin did know Gaylord Stavely.
And Georgie, Georgie White, and...
Oh, yes, of course. We always ran across Georgie. She had these pontoons.
Yeah, Don Hatch and Ted Hatch.
Yes.
Just some of the people there in the 1950s, 1960s. Let's see, there was a guy, Joe Monroe?
It was Ron Smith. Ron Smith, I think, was one of the ones I remember because he had the most user days.
Okay. And Bill Belknap?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, we knew Bill Belknap. And we used his guidebooks. We would get his guidebooks for the passenger, for the people on the river trips.
Okay. Yeah. Bill was a photographer as well, so he would have had a lot in common with Martin. His kids were older, I think. Yeah.
We did meet his daughter one of the times when we were in Hawaii. For some reason, she was in Hawaii, and we caught up with her there, but I don't remember what year it was.
Was that Loewy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. Fun. Okay. All right. I just wonder if you had any thoughts and Martin had any thoughts on the loss of Glen Canyon.
Enjoyed books that have, let's see, Tad Nichols had a black and white photography book of Glen Canyon before it was flooded in. And I've only seen pictures of it because I never made it, never got to it.
Right. Okay. All right.
I was always sorry. Dave Brower just felt so guilty about Glen Canyon. It bothered him, I think, to the day he died.
I bet it was a gorgeous, gorgeous place.
Yes.
But that was a well, very fascinating issue there.
Yes, it was.
So once again, we've yik-yaked for about an hour. Maybe this is a good place to wrap this up, and next time we'll pick up 1968.
Oh, I
Okay.
should go back and tell you when we moved into our house, it was 58 or 59, and my daughter started school at Portola Valley. She came home all bubbly the first day because she had met the librarian, and my daughter loved books. And so she volunteered to work in the library. And the librarian said, "Well, I'd love to have you. This will be just fine. And tell your mother if she wants to volunteer. I have a book mending group that meets. Maybe she'd like to join them." So I did. And well, for many years, the ladies would come to my house. It would be like once a month, I would pick up the books that had to be mended. Pages torn, different things that we could fix before they went back on the shelf. So that was my activity from that particular year to 1968 when Martin left Sunset.
Nice. Oh, that's fun.
Actually, when we moved into the Bay Area, it was a hotbed of conservation issues. And Martin got involved in the Committee for Green Foothills, which was started by Wallace Stegner. And then also there was a big conservation fight for the building of the freeway, the 280, which was supposed to go through Stanford Glen, but they objected to that, so it was pushed up toward the foothills. And one of the first battles of the Committee for Green Foothills was based on the fact that Stanford and their outlying lands kept creeping up into the foothills, and the foothills were precious to the people who lived near them, and they objected to Stanford's plans for development in the foothills. So that's another story. But as a
Okay.
result of the Committee for Green Foothills, the later organization, which was the Peninsula, it was called POST, Peninsula, I can't remember what it stands for, but it's POST, and it's been a very effective conservation organization for the foothills and the farmland on the coast side of the Coast Range. It's been a very, very excellent conservation group. And
Nice.
well, if I say at that time there was a lot of conservation turmoil going on, and Martin got involved in all of it.
Okay, well, let's pick up 1968 in
I'm afraid it's a period when there was so much going on, I can't keep track.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing what you do remember, and I think I'll ask you next time about Wallace Stegner as well. That's
Yes, okay.
another name. All right, well, then let's conclude part four, oral history interview with Esther Litton. Today is Monday, May 25th, 2020. And Esther, thank you so very much.
Well, have I made any
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, it's amazing. Your memory, your ability to remember all these various travels. It's just wonderful.
Well, I have a lot of the magazine covers that Martin shot. I'll go back over them and see what years we did what. Maybe that'll help.
Okay, hang on a second.